Hey, Joe. Oh my God. This is so exciting to have you on. So
welcome, Joe.
Now, walk us through exactly what causes you to be on this show, because it's still a mystery to me that you ended up here. It's like you opened up a random door to a random bar, and here you are, and here we're hanging out.
Well, look, I think that there's a lot of bars in the world, if we want to keep playing on this metaphor, and there's ones that you happen to stumble upon that you feel a connection with, both in terms of like the culture and the spirit of it, and then you want to be part of it. And so I feel like when I saw even just the naming of this podcast, Second Time Founders, I said in my response back that like, I'm not a second time founder, so I don't know if I'm like welcome on this podcast, but I did feel like the spirit of why you all were doing this was, I thought back to the early days of Loom. I was like, man, I wish more than anything that there was just a frank, no bullshit sort of podcast out there that I could learn from founders who have been there and done that before.
And we are so, first of all, I will say I'm a heavy Loom user, hardcore. And it is, I think you should be very proud of that product. I know Shahid from before I used Loom, and he's one of my investors, and we spent some time in Italy together wandering around pre-pandemic. It was really fun. And
look at the bougie stuff you do.
Please, you live in a gigantic, in literally like the 47th floor of a fucking building. I live on a ground floor fucking piece of shit 100-year-old building. You are far more bougie than me. Here's what I'm trying to get to, I think. The story that I really like about Loom is that it's not one of those instant successes. I want to hear it from you. I'm really excited to have you on here and hear about this because it inspires me. It inspires me because sometimes you are grinding and you're like, oh my God, are we ever going to get there? Is this going to work? This feeling that all founders have. But Loom is a story to me of an amazing product that didn't start out amazing. And I would love to hear that from your own words.
For sure. I mean, I was thinking about some of the stories that I hadn't thought about in a while coming into this podcast, one of which, Kevin, when we were like earliest days of Loom, and at the time it was open test, we used Ship. And we found that to be like a magical experience. And there's just this element of like, man, like if only one day we could get to the level of like branding and product and execution that Ship was at, like, my goodness, what a bar to set. And it was Shahid and I in an apartment in Santa Monica when he was like, hey, by the way, we should check this out. He was actually moving back up to San Francisco at the time. And so he was shipping some of his stuff and saw that experience and ends. But we had already started kind of like poking at and working on a concept together, a project is what you could call it. So Julian, to get to your actual question, for Loom, in the earliest days, it was Shahid, Vinay, and myself that were like became fast friends. And we had a perfect triarchy of experience and skill set because Shahid was a designer by trade. Then he went to the dark side of like VC. Then he was like, I'm coming back. I'm going to be a builder again. I was a product manager at a startup in LA. And then Vinay was an engineer. And we went out to the bar one night. We came back and we sat down and we were like, why are we not building together? You know, like, why are we just going out and kind of like wasting this like magical chemistry? And so we showed up one Sunday to a whiteboard. And we all had to bring three ideas to it. By the way, it was like a virtual whiteboard because I was the only person left in LA and they were both up in San Francisco. Right. But we just wanted to pick one idea and start working on it together. And so the idea itself at the time was we were going to build a video feedback marketplace. So you would get product experts like the folks that are on this call. And we would pair it up with folks that maybe wanted feedback at various stages of the product lifecycle. It could be a product requirement doc. It could be prototypes. It could be a shipped product that's on staging or fully productionized product. And we wanted to build a two-sided marketplace to give video feedback on whatever you all were at in the product building process. Now, when you started that, I think that this, at least Julian and Kevin, you all know about marketplace dynamics and how difficult they are. We built a working prototype of it, but it was totally duct taped together. Like, we were using QuickTime on Macs to like give the feedback. We were trying to tell, you know, product designers at Google that like just use QuickTime to record something and we'll like manually upload it on our end in order to deliver it to the clientele. We were like doing manual payment processing in terms of getting money from the clients to the experts. And very quickly, we got feedback from our, essentially the folks that we wanted to sell it into, was that it was super early stage startups that had no money to pay these experts that were trying to charge like $100 or $150 per video. And like that just like the marketplace does not line up.
Right.
But when we were talking to the companies that did have some dollars to them, they're like, we actually just want this sort of video feedback from our users.
Right.
And so what we did was we pivoted there and we built a JavaScript widget that had like essentially an NPS survey, smiley face, neutral face, sad face.
Mm-hmm.
And if you answered that, we would give you a carrot, which is like, hey, we actually had Soylent that had it on their website. And if you wanted 15% discount on your Soylent order, would you take a few minutes to record a video of your experience? And so essentially we built that, but like, to be clear, as a product manager and Shahid as designer, it wasn't that much work relative to Vinay and engineering. Like, that's a relatively complex system. We're talking about JavaScript widget, a Chrome extension to record videos, and then like the video hosting library and delivery of them. And so Shahid and I spent a ton of time talking to customers directly. And after 2 to 3 months of us building that platform, so now we're about 5 months in and like not really getting the traction that we're looking for, launching on Product Hunt, having those classic spikes up in the first 12 hours, pretty much right back down to zero, but still enough contacts to be able to reach out to folks and get feedback. We started hearing more and more often from folks that like, this Chrome extension recorder is pretty interesting. Like the screen, camera bubble, like I would actually like to record videos like this generally for all these different use cases. And we were going back to Vinay, who's like exhausted at this point. You know? We're like, hey, we have another major pivot that we want to do. Can we separate out this Chrome extension from everything else that you built and then launch it as a standalone? And he was like, y'all, this is by far the easiest thing you've asked me to do. Look at Chrome extension, to have it be standalone. Like, yes, absolutely. And so we did that. And then we launched again on Product Hunt. And I was at a friend's wedding at the time in Chicago. I felt really guilty because we were literally like on our last dollars. We had 14 days left of like runway because like personal check-in had raised $20,000, which was enough for me to move from LA to San Francisco. And I was sitting on a twin mattress on Shahid's bedroom floor. Like that was like, and we were 6-7 months in. And I went to a friend's wedding and I couldn't skip it. It was like one of my best friends of all time. And I woke up on Saturday, we had launched on a Friday, and we were having more users sign up on that Saturday than Friday, right?
That's so awesome.
Product Hunt launch up and back down, that wasn't playing out. And I turned to my girlfriend at the time, who's now my wife, and I was like, we did it. I have no fucking idea what we did. And it's kind of, we can go from there. But like, really, it was 7 months of absolutely like grueling grinding, 7 days a week, 16 hour days against on a mattress on the floor sort of thing.
Andy, I hear your, I see you're perking up a little bit. What is it? What are you thinking?
So Joe, here's what I want to know. I mean, like, I've seen the idea, the first idea you've started with, the live feedback on a website pitch, probably, I don't know, 50 times now, and I'm sure you have too. I'm sure everyone here has. What gave you the intuition to know to pivot? Who wasn't on the team? How did it all work? Because I've seen so many other companies try to do what you're describing was V2, I guess, and they never make that pivot and it never goes anywhere.
I think that to me, what I've said over the course of time with now Loom is that we borderline I think, have process power almost, because we are creating behavior in the workplace that has like very, very nuanced user experience elements that get people to feel comfortable with recording video in a workplace context. And that actually goes back to when we had built the initial JavaScript widget and we had built the initial kind of like screen recorder. I think that there was some special elements that we had just done in the early days that was like, hey, this camera bubble that sits in the bottom left corner. Now, like a lot of folks have replicated that and they should, but to superimpose the camera bubble on top of the screen recording, I think was like a really unique component to open test at the time that actually said, like folks are like, oh, I want to record these sorts of videos. So when you have the two-sided marketplace that we were talking about, or like end users recording videos for companies, it wasn't that translation from the companies that were collecting videos to be like, oh, I want this for myself. So I think because we had that unique element of the camera bubble superimposed, it allowed people to think about that screen recording element in a different and unique way, such that they wanted it for other use cases. So I think that the reason that we were able to make that leap was actually like a truly fortunate and lucky thing that we were like, hey, the human component of feedback is so important. Facial expressions, right? Like what they're actually looking at on the screen is really, really important. And I think that real-time user videos from like companies that are collecting them, the like V2 version of Bloom, never had a superimposed camera bubble before.
Joe, was that Saturday, sounds like a very early period, but was that product market fit, or was that just, oh, okay, I guess we're going to keep going and we'll find product market fit? At which point, then my question would be like, how did it feel when you got it?
Definitely not product market fit, right? Like I think that willingness to pay is unbelievably important, because if you're going to build a business, like you need cash flow, right? So yes. We had just gotten to a point of there was more usage and users that were coming into the top. So like when I say we did it, we were in touch with like, I don't know, we had pitched 50 different investors at the time. Like I said, we had only raised $20,000. And this was over the course of seven months.
What year is this? Remind everybody.
Yeah. So we started building in September of 2015. We launched a web extension in June of 2016. When I said that, like, we did it, I felt like we had the conviction that we'd be able to raise more capital, right? Yeah. Because we have existing users and usage and a viral component, like an early.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And so, like, the next step of that was, like, I flew back on Sunday. We had a meeting with an investor that we had been staying in touch with really closely, sending weekly updates, because, like, that's how desperate we were. You know, like, we were 14 days left of personal cash that we were burning through. And we sent them the update from, like, the Friday to Sunday numbers. And they were in the San Mateo apartment on Tuesday. They bought us Chipotle burritos to extend our runway by a couple of days. And then they wired us a check even before the end of the following week, because they were like, we'll figure out the deal terms. You know, we'll hammer out the legal, but we know you need money now. And that was 15, 17 funds. I don't know if you all know Daniel, Danielle and Michael, but they are the early creators of the Thiel Fellowship.
Oh,
and then
cool.
They spun out and they created their own VC funds.
Yes, I do know Daniel. I just didn't know the name of the fund. Yeah.
Somebody mentioned their name recently to me and I had never heard of them before. So I guess it all checks out.
Do you, Joe, think that, so you guys pivoting like three times within 7 months, now looking back, how big is Loom today as far as employees go?
185 individuals.
So curious for all the audience, like, do you think, and just try to imagine now making some sort of pivot like that, if what the size that you're at, do you think that the, running out of money, small team was allowing you to really pivot?
It's a great story. It's a great story. Yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that the combination of, we all went into it, and I think that this is important when you're starting a company with others, is like, how much are you willing to give and commit
Right.
And like, what is the ownership structure on the other side? And so like the three of us, we're all equal co-founders from an equity perspective. I think that that's always like a dangerous thing. If you have like a 50, 20, 30 split across founders, right? It should be one third, one third, one third, or 50, 50. And then the commitment up front is like, we're willing to like quit our day jobs.
Yes. Right?
Like we're willing to give as many hours as the others are giving. And, literally I said that all I need is like I'd set the threshold of $20,000 for us to raise, and then I'll uproot my life and move to San Francisco.
Right.
And we all lived in the same apartment, and we were willing to work 7 days a week, 1600 days. And so to me, I think that the principles and the commitments to one another was equally important as the size of the team itself. But like, yes, small teams being able to pivot is like unbelievably important. Like it, when we're 185 folks now, you know, I have more.
Could you imagine?
Yeah. I have more quote unquote like frustrations in terms of we're all founders, we're all builders. And it's like, we want to do these things. And like, you have to work through the system in order to get certain things done. And that just takes time to like steer the ship as the ship gets bigger.
It's such a challenge because you're describing a mechanism. The ideal, right, is all three people can write code, of course.
Yeah.
That never happens. And so you find yourself in the early days, certainly I did in the early days of this company and the prior company, being like, man, I wish I could write code. Like, I would be so much more useful in these early days. I'm useful later, I hope. But like, but in day one, that you know, you were just dependent on one guy just grinding. And that's why it's so hard not to take money, because not everyone can write that code.
Yeah. And to be clear, we wanted money, right? Like
Yeah.
I think that was the job that I had, which is like trying to go out and get funds when I was failing spectacularly at it, you know? And so like, I think that to me is, you need somebody who's continuously building and improving on the product, while like, I do think that the CEO role is really important even in the earliest days, because I think what we made the failure of in the first 3 to 4 months, to be clear, was that it was a little bit of a divide and conquer on the fundraising front, because you tend to raise, it was a pre-seed round. And so that is like friends and family. And so like, does Binay go to his friends and family and like pitch Loom? And like Shahid does the same thing with his network and I do with mine. And so we were all kind of doing it, but that was a mistake. Like until we officially anointed one person is in charge of fundraising, even in talking to like Binay's parents, you know, like that should have been me in the early days, because you actually learn a lot in the individual conversations, what resonates with what types of folks. And I'm not saying that you should be VC or investor driven in terms of what you build and why, but how you frame certain components of the business to investors is really, really important. Like I learned, I mean, like the like standard 8-slide deck, the Sequoia blog post, I still think is like the best early stage deck template to work from.
Yep.
But within the each individual slide, how you frame it up. Like if I go back to the earliest deck, we had so many words on the slide, right? And like as a result of understanding which one or two points, then you can translate those individuals. And so all that's to say is I think that, yes, engineering, I think about the desire to code all the time. Hopefully GPT-4 and beyond can help me get there in terms of that producing code. But I think that has always been my biggest deficit as a founder and builder, is I don't write code myself.
When Loom was originally, whoever the first person is that mentions it to me, they say it's Instagram for business. Do you remember being referred to this way? Because to me, I don't know if people still do, but it is completely off base. But the thing that's challenging is that that people have no frame of reference exactly for what it is. We were talking about it just before you hopped onto the call. I believe your company will go public. I believe this for many, many years. And I think that there's enormous room for it. Yeah, that's right. We are rooting for you. How does one gauge the market for something like this? Right? Like, it's not even like people are, it's collaboration software. Like, talk to me about how you get people inspired about it, how you pitch it to people, how to tell people that it is a big opportunity versus some niche thing.
Yeah, candidly, I would say like we still struggle with this to some degree, because I think that there's tension in terms of how you communicate yes. the opportunity that you're tackling to which audiences, right? So when you're recruiting somebody, obviously you want to paint the like biggest, grandest vision, but you also want to be very clear about what challenges that you're tackling right now over the next 12 to 24 months. So they have clarity about what their role is coming in. But when it comes to users who are coming into the top of the funnel, you want to be as clear with your value proposition that is like the wedge into hopefully over the course of time, they can become a Julian in terms of like usage and like using it for a variety of use cases. But what is that wedge use case? And when Loom has been truly like hyper horizontal from the start. So the earliest surveys that we ran, we were just trying to get an understanding of role, company size, you know, industry.
Right.
And it was day traders in Brazil walking through like charts about how they're right. moving on any given day.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Like we figured that out because Vinay had to do dig into why a video wasn't playing back in the way. And he was like, are you okay if I watch it? And he did. And it's somebody yelling in Portuguese. And he was like, can I ask you what you're like talking about? And he was like, well, I'm giving feedback to one of my peers about a trade, a specific trade that they made. Mm-hmm. And then one of the next conversations we had was a student who went abroad for school and university who was sending looms to their grandmother about like their explorations and the work that they're doing at university. And it was like, I'm able to stay in contact with my grandmother in a way that I haven't been able to because we're 10 hours time zone difference. And so like, it was hyper horizontal from the beginning. And so like, how do you convey the value of Loom and what we're going after? Ultimately, what we believe is the like core and the kernel, and like this does go across the three pivots that we made, is like, we believe that video had a much, much more important role to play for people at work than it did back in like 2015. So mm-hmm. I was living in LA during the rise of like Snapchat from 2012 to 2015. Right? And like you see individuals communicating on a very visual and like video oriented basis, like day in, day out. Then you show up to work. And at the time we were using like Microsoft Outlook at the company I was working at called My Life. Like one felt like the future, the other felt like the past. And so how do we take this video native comfort and bring it to the workplace when we know that like video is growing exponentially? We also looked at like Mary Meeker's Internet Trends report, and you saw that like video was the biggest block of traffic on the internet. It was also the fastest growing. And so when we saw that, we were like, this is an absolutely massive opportunity, and we need to figure out how to make video more valuable to folks at work. And so we were fortunate to be able to go from like more specific kind of like what I would say niche marketplace to generalized communication tool. And like, that's actually what we've been building. I think when you're Julian asking, like, are we a collaboration tool? I think we're like increasingly stepping our way into that as potential additional value for our user base, but we've really been a communication tool for a very long time. Like I have an idea, I want to communicate it as efficiently and effectively as possible. I record it. It's like an invisible window that sits on top of anything. And then we give you a hyperlink that you can share anywhere. And so it ends up getting distributed via Slack or email or, you know, your project management tool. And so we're more of a communication tool, but we think that we can build a collaboration platform over the course of time, because we've had organizations go from, let's just call it like 200 videos from what we understood prior to using Loom. Now they have 250,000 videos that are across the organization. So you become an institutional store of knowledge, and you become a, like, I'm going to comment on this specific timestamp in this video. And so you collect more metadata over the course of time. And so I think that we need to continue to build towards a collaboration platform, but we're more of a communication tool today.
Yeah. It is so interesting to it really, what you're talking about really resonates with me when I think about the way that we use Loom in our workplace. It were totally asynchronous. I want to hear your pandemic story. It probably was wild. I've heard versions of it in the back, but I'm also really interested about reducing friction. What it seemed like happened, it is similar, and I'm not comparing you to Clubhouse, to be clear. But Clubhouse was incredible to two founders at reducing friction to someone becoming an active user, right? Because you would launch the app if you were an early Clubhouse user, and I was very close to early, and then boom, you were just talking with the founders. It was an incredible experience, and several times they shut the company or the product down and then recreated a lower friction version. First it was talk show, and then it was like another version of it. And then finally everyone's on the show. And so it sounds like there was a similar process of reduction of friction for you, where you're like, this is still too hard. This is still too hard. It sounds like one of the gems was that corner photo or that corner video that you create, which helps you feel comfortable, let's say, about the video. So I'm curious about friction reduction, and I'm curious about the pandemic. You could start whichever way you want.
For sure. I mean, it's interesting, the friction component, because it does bring me back to what you were saying of like comparisons to Instagram. Mikey and Kevin are investors in Loom. They invested in the Series B rounds. And the reason why they invested specifically is that Mikey said that the level of friction associated with recording a video and sending it out reminded him of the early days and some of the magic that they did with Instagram. Because what a lot of people forget is like the first year is that uploading a photo to the internet was actually like a relatively lengthy process, especially when you're on 3G on your phone.
Right.
And so they did a lot of things in the background to optimize that process and to allow you to edit the photo in a way that they're still uploading in the background, and then they superimpose the filter on it after the fact. And so they created this process that felt frictionless in terms of uploading a photo, even though it wasn't in the background. And we did a similar thing with Loom, where the biggest friction that we actually solved and why folks were using it in the early days is that recording a screen recording with QuickTime and then uploading it to someplace like Dropbox, we're talking about like a 15 to 20 minute process. Mm-hmm. And like, again, like this is back in 2015, there's a lot of like cloud storage optimization that allows you to upload lengthy videos that are relatively quickly. But that was the key friction that we solved in the early days. And we actually, this is something that, again, we put Vinay put us on his backs in the early days, is like he built now a patented video streaming infrastructure such that when you are recording a video, we're breaking it down to playlist files and then streaming that up to the server. So right when you click done recording, we've already uploaded 90 to 95% of the video.
Right.
But we're just finishing those last few seconds by the time you land on the web page. So that was the biggest friction that we solved. And we said to investors in the early days, when you reduce friction, right, it's directly correlative, arguably the most correlative component in our business to creating this behavior at scale. Right. Mm. So I think that from a video perspective, and Andy probably has a lot of thoughts on from like a video infrastructure perspective in terms of what y'all have done with Foul, but like that is where the most friction can be reduced. And then from I think the other part is there's a very human psychology component to Loom of what you see your own face.
Totally is.
Do I sound good? Did I stumble? Did I make a mistake? And so that's part of the process power that I talked about, is like, how do you make individuals comfortable and confident in recording a Loom video? And some of like the earliest things that we did was not even in necessarily making the recording menu more intuitive. It's actually leaning into the human psychology component. So in the camera bubble and the Chrome extension, one of the biggest things that we resulted in, video first views is what we call it. It's like our activation metric. You can record a video, but until you send it to somebody else on our platform, you're not activated on our
platform.
So like one of the biggest wins that we ever had was just actually having a loading image with like a pithy phrase and an emoji that was like, you look great today, with like the smiling emoji. or did you get a haircut? You know, like these sorts of things that are confidence builders for individuals that like enable them to feel more comfortable and confident in recording a video. And we've done a ton of those things over the course of time, such that you feel more comfortable recording and sharing, because people hate the sound of their own voices, right? Like and people think that they sound stupid unless you play them back at 1.5x. Like if you looked at your metrics, like most people probably listen at 1.25 or 1.5. So that was another friction point that like we enabled people to watch Looms back at like 1.5 or 2x. And that immediately was like, oh, I sound like a genius right now.
You know? Oh, that's so interesting.
I can't watch video at, I could not agree with you more. I can't watch asynchronous or even synchronous now at 1x.
Yeah.
1.2 is minimum.
People do sound, they legitimately sound stupid because you're thinking faster than the verbalization is happening is what I suspect is going
on. Wait, so Andy, you don't listen to this podcast?
I listen to it at 1.25x.
Okay.
1.5.
Especially your part. Yeah.
When I want to learn and consume, I'm 1.5x.
I totally agree.
I find 1x too slow.
Yeah. You're so processing things, right? Audiobooks, everything. And so it's interesting, Joe, what you're saying, because I know that you default videos to 1.2x playback, actually, now, right? And it is, that's just one. I'm just fascinated by this. To me, a customer, I've always started with some level of free usage in my companies, but actually what I am learning as we are in bottom up, right, where people are beginning with a free trial and they want to get comfortable with the product. And for you, in your case, it's a lot of free usage as well. And consumption is that engagement is leading as an indicator towards monetization.
Yep.
And so I have to rewrite my brain around this and think, oh, actually I should get people to use things instead of pay. But I find that harder and more challenging because it's free and I'm just like, fucking nobody wants to pay for anything, just pay me. And did you struggle with that at all?
Yes, from a variety of vectors. One was that when we went to go raise our Series A, so we had raised a pre-seed, we had raised a seed, you could get away with like having no revenue at the seed rounds back in 2017. But when we were going to raise our A, and you're supposedly a B2B SaaS product that has no revenue,
right?
That was like a filter for 80% of investors. They were like, nope, I'm good. You know, come back to us when you start generating revenue. The reason why we had delayed revenue for so long was that, and again, Andy, you can attest to this, is like video infrastructure is incredibly difficult when you're like going as close to the metal as possible from like a performance perspective. And when you're trying to create behavior at scale, like we had decided in the early days when we saw we were very horizontal that we were going to go for the horizontal opportunity, which is really hard. And so like we put off critical things like when and why should people pay? And so we got a lot of questions is like, are you all building a consumer product in disguise and like claiming that you're B2B, but you're actually a young consumer? And we're like, no. Give us a little bit of time here. So we actually only started monetizing in 2019. But what we did...
How did you convince those? So it sounded like 80% of people wouldn't invest at all, even look at the deal because you didn't monetize. How did you get that Series A done without any monetization?
It truly was just through like volume of users and usage, right? So like a conviction that when we showed progress that we said in 2018, we were really, really focused on activation. We had just started doing more intensive growth experimentation. And we took the activation rate from 8% to 16% over the course of 6 months. Right? So like showing that we could focus on a domain and then that leads to more engagement and users and usage, I think was really important. I also think that there's just founder investor fit or like market product investor fit.
Yes.
And so the 80% was really helpful, actually, because we got down to a subset of investors that one, truly believed in the space, and two, had like a perspective on what we could do if we did just focus on the fundamentals and foundations of the business. So we had identified that like Ilya Fushman at the time, he was at Index Ventures.
Yep.
We tried to get him to invest in our seed rounds. because he was head of product for Dropbox for 4 years in the earliest days. And so from a viral mechanism component of like, essentially we're UGC, but it was like content uploaded to Dropbox, share link with others, and that leads to virality and like growth within organizations. You're like, he is the ideal investor. And so we tried to get Index to do it at Seed Round, didn't get that done, but he had moved over to Kleiner Perkins and he was like, we're doing the Series A. And so I think that for me, when I was going out and pitching other investors and the 80% that said no, it was just trying to do my job as CEO, which is to create competition for the deal, even though we knew that we wanted to go with Elliott and Kleiner.
I do have, this is something that I think a number of us that on the, here on the panel can kind of like speak to, is do you find, it sounds like you have an experience, Joe, which is the person that passed in the previous round is actually highly likely to do it in the next round. And I don't know if this is matched out for you, but it's certainly matched out for me at Breather. And I think it kind of turned out at the very beginning here at Practice too. I'm wondering if you have that same thing. Someone passed at the seed and then did it at the A. Someone passed at the A and then did it at the B. Did you find that?
Yeah, I think that what I learned, and I think as a founder, like for all those first-time founders out there listening, you'll learn how to do fundraising more effectively, not just like within rounds, but from one round to the next. Mm-hmm. So I think that the important criteria that you should get is like an investor, if they go deeper than the initial 30-minute coffee meeting or like 30-minute Zoom meeting, then they're genuinely interested in the business, right? And if they do end up deciding to pass, you should ask the explicit question, which is, why exactly did you pass? And what progress would you like to see from this round to the next, mm-hmm. such that you'd be interested, right? Get really clear criteria as to why they passed and what they would like to see. And if you can show that you made that progress over that course of time, mm-hmm. that actually is a signal to them that it's going to be a good partnership.
Right? Just good feedback.
I have a counterpoint because to that point, Joe, just because I think that, so you did your A and you said like 2017 probably or something.
We closed in Jan of 2019.
2019. Okay. I think what I've experienced anyways, is that the VC community has went deeper in certain areas and they just, are not interested at all. I speak from experience, like we're logistics tech and there's just certain investors, like no matter what metrics we put up, they're just like, I have no idea what the fuck you guys are doing. Okay. I don't know how to assess that. And they hate that, which is really, frustrating, especially, because like, I've been on the deck in the, Bay Area and fostering relationships for the last decade. And I have these people that like, they would invest in a pure software, which we are today, but like they don't want to talk about logistics. They won't do it. And so I think that what has happened, and maybe it's not applicable to what you guys are doing because you're more generalized, but people kind of pigeonhole me in a lot of other categories, probably like, I can't think of any other kind of categories, but they'll just like, no matter what, I just won't touch this stuff because there's so many investors now that just go deep in certain categories and they spend so much time. And so they may even take the meeting, but then I usually find that their follow-up is like kind of like garbage. It's like, oh, we just want to see more growth. But honestly, it's just like, we just don't want to invest in this industry, but they're not going to actually say that to you. Mm-hmm. So sometimes you do definitely, I think that as the VC industry has gotten more deep in certain areas, you kind of need to read in between the lines sometimes, but that definitely was the case before. It didn't matter. So like, oh, look at Flexport, right? Like they're a freight forwarder. Everybody just saw their growth and they're like, yeah, we're all generalist investors. And like, it was a super hot deal. Like now I don't believe that Flexport probably could have got done by a lot of the VCs that probably did it because they're super focused in like, in AI now and all these other different things. And so I found the feedback, you really need to read between the tea leaves and then focus on and find the people who really love, like you did with Ilya, it's like that they really love the space, they totally understand it, and then go after those types of people. But I think the VC industry has changed. I don't know if you guys, anybody else here has a similar opinion or disagrees with me.
I think you're in a very specific scenario.
No,
come on.
I think you're in a very specific industry.
Healthcare, like, there's lots of industries like that a lot of VCs won't touch.
There's certainly some industries that have been where there's large scar tissue for sure. And that's actually going back to Joe's point about getting past when they're like, you have a B2B company with no revenue. What the hell are you really? And as if you're trying to dissimulate that to hide a B2C company underneath to try and like get your round done or something like that.
Yeah.
To me, right. If I understand correctly, the Sequoia round, which I think is a Series B that the guy did, who looks like he's 16 years old forever, or whatever his name is. What's his
Andrew
name?
Andrew Reed. Yeah,
there we go. Yeah, Andy Reed. Andrew Reed.
Child BC.
He's a great guy. but that was a defining round for you. You just said that that's when the Instagram founders came in. Is that right? You were like, it was hard before, and I'm certain it became maybe more easy afterwards. Is that right?
Yeah, what I would say that one of the things that really helped us from the Series A to Series B, because you know, one of the questions was like, how do you actually get the Series A done? Like, first component was like showing that we could make progress on the things that we said that we were going to. Mm. But then the second thing that Ilya helped us understand was that, well, you are a B2B company. You just need to be able to speak to that intimately from a numbers perspective. Mm. I think on a previous episode, Kevin, you were talking about like the DoorDash founders knew their numbers better than anyone, right? Mm. So when you're building for a specific opportunity, you need to be able to speak to that. And I think that I was learning how to like convey the intra company viral components, not just the macro viral components.
Right.
And so when you can show that this is how we're growing within organizations, even before we were like monetizing or even had a team product, you know, like showing that growth within organizations and speak intimately to that. But the real breakthrough moment for us in the Series A, now as we get to the Series B that you were talking about, Julian, like we not only were speaking about the company in that way, but we were building towards it as well. So when Sequoia led the Series B in late 2019, we closed in September, we were building towards a team product based off of the insights that we had from going through the Series A. And I actually wrote up a document for Lumates broadly, which is like Series A learnings. Like, what did we learn by going out to market and what was important for the investors that helped further our understanding of our opportunity in front of us? And that team and intra-company virality was really important. So we started to build Loom for Teams. That was our opportunity to continue to further monetize. Because the only paid plan that we had post Series A was a pro plan and a free plan, but that was individualistic in nature. So, you know, Sequoia and Andrew Reed saw that we were building the team plan, which is like business and enterprise. And they're like, okay, now they're like really getting an understanding of the business and opportunity they're going after and continue to grow from like a user and usage perspective. So monetization is coming imminently.
Yeah, you got.
I think you had a great point about going back to the same investors. I've never had it happen to me, but I've had heard it from other founders when you come back 9 months later and you did exactly what you said you will do.
Yes.
And they just want to jump on the deal. And I met somebody this past weekend who said exactly the same thing. And then the person who led his A was somebody who passed on his seed and they had just kept in touch. He sent numbers like every half a year. And finally, they did it like 9 months later.
Yeah,
it yet to happen to me.
You know, I'll go further. I think I have a particular thing because I think this is sort of a moment of self-reflection where I'm being exceptionally transparent. It's like, I think I come off like an asshole the first time people meet me. And so, to investors. and so they're like, who is this dick with lots of tattoos who like clearly isn't like one of us or Stanford people or something? And so like a year later, they're like, oh,
also Canadian.
Okay. So he's like not so crazy or something. So I think that's why it's happened. At the seed, Schlaf passed from RE, you know him, Andy. Anthony did the A. B is the one exception where the rando guys that Peter's Valar Fund did it. And then Menlo passed it to B, did the C. And it just kept going like this. And so same thing with Andreessen this time. So I think there's a path there to people. And your comment, Joe, about saying, and then ask them precisely what it is that it's going to take. I think that's astute, and I'm going to 100% take it.
I thought it was very good also.
Yeah. I mean, the one thing that I'd break down to and what it shows investors that you were talking about, Andy, which is like, there's ability to execute, right? Like that's really important. It's like, I'm saying I'm going to do this, I'm doing it. I think that another component that, especially when you're still in nebulous early stages of a company, right? There's like a lot of times that I spend with early time founders, like one of the challenges that they have is how nebulous things are still, right? Like there's so much different feedback, so many different directions that you could go. And ultimately you have to pick a path, right? So your conviction. And so I think that there is an element of like, I can execute and say what I'm going to do. It's also like, I have conviction and that I have good intuition on which direction that we should take this. And so I think that when you think about your relationship with investors, even when you get deep, and like now I've been working together with Ilya and Andrew as board members for years and years, like you realize that ultimately they can help shape the path that you're on. They can help remove barriers at certain junctures, but like you're the one who's like picking the road that you're traveling. Yep. And conviction and intuition and ability to execute is like really, really important for investors to see. And if you can prove that from one stage to the next, I think is when investors get really, really excited, because it's a mutual opt-in, but you're both opting in for a 10-year relationship.
Yeah.
Right.
And so like, that's a long time to spend together. And they want to be like, okay, this is going to be not just a fortuitous relationship, but it's going to be fun. And like, we're going to be able to make bets together.
Yeah.
And like, I think that that's a really important component, is like, can you align on the way in which you see the world? And then are they going to be able to trust that you're going to come back with new insights and that you can wrestle with those together? So
John Doerr, John Doerr always, was like, I want to invest in people I want to get in trouble with. That was like his big, big thing.
That's a good line.
Totally. Totally.
Andy.
Yeah. I mean, I think most first time founders don't understand this, but it's basically 90 day fiance and you have to get married and there is no divorce at the end. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's like the best analogy that I try to drill into people. I think the second thing that you don't realize as a first time founder is people want the team to have a perspective and a plan. And I think you start to realize that you don't realize that maybe in year one, you probably realize that it working with Ilya in year two, they're waiting for you to come with a plan. And they're waiting for you as the CEO to say what you are going to do. And their response back is to provide advice and questions to peel away the onion versus tell you what to do.
They do not want to tell you what to do.
No,
you lose
all credibility.
You're
as a
fucked
CEO.
If they do, you're fired. What to do.
Like
you're
tier fired. Three VCs tell you what to do. Tier
they
one
do.
VCs
they
wait
do.
For you to present a plan,
right?
And ask you, okay, Joe, how are you going to do? What is the cost behind this? And how are you going to hire all the people?
Right. Yeah.
And I think that the tier one VCs, like the mantra that I've heard that they have is like, do no harm. Right. So like, I think first time founders, they're like in the same way that as you learn as CEO, that you have a ton of weight with the internal team. And like, there's a lot of times that you have to learn this the hard way, which is like you say something in one meeting a month ago and then it comes back and you're like, okay, first, like that wasn't the interpretation. And two, like we just wasted a ton of time. And so I think that a lot of investors tier one have learned that lesson. Is that like if they say something to a founder and CEO, that then they come back 3 months later in a board meeting and they're like, ooh, that wasn't what I meant. And like, you know, we wasted a bunch of time here. Like, I'm not here to tell you what to do. There's the mantra of like, do no harm from the best VCs. And I think that that's what you're like, they're waiting for you to come up with a plan.
Completely.
And when you do, they're going to help shape it, right? But they're not going to tell you what roads to travel.
Andy?
Yeah, no, I think what was pivotal for me was reading Amped It Up. Maybe you read it, Joe.
Yes.
And this is his mantra, basically. You're the CEO. You're in charge. You have to tell the board what your plan is.
Yes.
And sometimes you have to put your, trying to find a polite term to say it, on the line. And if anyone out there listening knows Slootman and wants to get him on our podcast, I would love to hear him say that.
We would literally kick Joe off right now. In order to bring Frank Slootman on.
I think you're a customer probably, so maybe you can help us out here with your rep. I bet you have a pretty big data warehouse.
There's a set of people who have a strong perspective. Another rando thing I heard once from an anonymous, very good operator is he said, this is really weird, but I'll say it here, is he's like, always get the CFO to say the numbers. I said, okay, in the board meeting. Why? He goes, because then if they're bad, they will blame the CFO and they won't blame you. I was like, really? And I did do that. But I don't know if that's true or not. But, you know, people give you funny, weird advice in this business.
That's a weird advice.
Isn't that strange?
Company advice.
You need to, as a CEO, you need to know your numbers cold.
Joe, what is a strong, unusual, like, really strong perspective, piece of advice that you've gotten in your time in this business?
You know, I think that to me, one of the things that is unbelievably important, like, especially in hard times, that I think that we're all like going through collectively as like an ecosystem of startups, right? Like it was pretty easy for a while there, you know, like 100 times revenue multiples, right? Yep. On product market fit, Series B's. And I think that to me, ultimately, what helps early stage companies, but also late stage companies alike, and this is a Slootman, like amp it up component, which is that like you have to continuously raise the talent bar over the course.
Yes.
Cannot let that slip. Especially when you're going through like a scaling component of your company where you're starting to hire more and more, you think it's actually going to be better if you just put butts in seat, but it becomes really hard, especially when you then like you have VPs, directors, managers, and then you're like a couple layers away from managers making hires, that like it becomes the gravity of like the talent bar is like pulling down, and it takes intensive energy and processes and like training to keep it up, but not just keep it up, but like raise it over the course of time. And so I would say like the number one piece of advice that I would give all founders is like never, ever, ever like let the talent bar drop and then continuously try and improve that. I think that it's a Bezos-ism, which is like, you know, you should want to be like, dang, I'm lucky I got hired 12 months ago because I'd never get hired today. Right. I think that that's like a really great narrative description of what you should try and accomplish at all times during your company's life cycle.
That's a fine.
I really believe that, but not everyone believes that. So do you practice calibration? So that's an amp it up mantra, basically.
Do you mean like performance reviews and calibrations?
But like literally bringing everyone into a room and saying, okay, so I think our VP of ops is great. What do you all think about him or her?
I haven't gotten to
that's
that
pretty point. Brutal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That is intense.
So you get to see not just what people who are doing 360 reviews say, but what the rest of the company thinks of that individual outside of their reporting line.
Wow. You got to be confident.
That's brutal.
That's incredible.
I think the opposite is definitely true. And I've seen this when, whether it be founders or employees or managers or whoever, they do hire the B and C players, because I think a lot of the times they're kind of afraid that if they hire somebody that's going to be better than them, then they're going to kind of be displaced, where it's really the opposite. Like you're trying to, whether you're a founder, CEO or a manager, whoever, you're trying to assemble a team that collectively is going to do this thing. And if you can actually attract amazing talent that is probably going to be better than you in certain areas or maybe on all the areas, you're just gonna like, that's your job to do, and you're gonna make the output of whatever the project or thing you're building just much better. And then that continuously scales. If you could build that into the culture of the company, like that's just like a massive leverage move that you have as a founder and CEO.
Joe, as we close out here, you're talking about talent. It's so important. It will always be important. How did you hire if there's a sort of a thing among them that you have in common, how did you hire the best people that you've ever worked with that have turned out to be great teammates from like an unusual place?
I think that to me, there's a book called Who. I don't know if y'all are familiar with it. It's Jeff Smart. They basically have they've had a consulting and recruitment agency for many, many years. And we got the advice from one of our seed investors that this is the book that you should basically just drag and drop from like a recruitment process perspective. And they have three core characteristics of like humble, hungry, smart. And smart is both IQ and EQ. The other thing that I would say that's like really specific and tactical in nature from that book is like there's a interview that really digs into the depths of like who somebody is and what decisions that they made over the course of their career. It's called a top grading interview. And it's actually hard to practice. We've gotten a lot of folks who say, I'm uncomfortable asking somebody like, okay, tell me about like your childhood, right? And like, what were some of the pivotal moments from that? And then you go from one big career or like life journey to the next. So like college, you know, and then you ask very precise questions of, okay, if you were to give yourself a score of 1 through 10, what would that be and why? Mm-hmm. And then the next question is like, when you actually get to their career stages, what score would your manager give you and why?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And why might there be a difference between the two scores if there are? And like, it has a very structured and rigid process that you go through. And that has been the most informative interview that I've ever gone through, because what you do is you peel back the layers of the onion to understand what is the core of an individual,
right?
What truly motivates and drives them.
Yeah.
And a lot of times we actually hear from interviewees, they're like, wow, like I actually learned a lot about myself from this interview. And I think that to me, when you can get to those core characteristics of humble, hungry, smart, like folks can come from anywhere and any discipline, right? Like in any industry. But if you understand their core motivations and then they have those core characteristics, then I think that you can get really, really talented people across the spectrum. So I think that that to me has been the way that we've been able to, at least in some windows of time, been like really good at recruiting and interviewing and like training our internal team to do so.
Thank you for coming on. I know everybody is busy on this thing. It was great to have you. We'd love to have you again.
Read
that book, Who. It's great. I love recruiting books like you do, and it's one of my favorites. And Joe, congratulations on your success, and see you down the line.
Yes, thanks for listening, everybody.
Thanks, Joe. And I don't think you can actually believe how much Julian loves your product. The amount of times he sent everyone here looms.
He sent me like 10 looms.
It's weird.
It's totally normal.
Julian is weird.
Loom anytime.
All right, take thanks, everyone.
Gentlemen, thank you very much.
All right, thanks.
Bye-bye. Founders Podcast, talking tech news. The show is a must, not some billionaire trying to sell you their book. We're coming from a real place, plenty ups and downs. Got some insights, join the discussion now. We being honest and raw, giving you real talk. We've been at the bottom and made it happen and much more. The Second Time Founders Podcast, more building, less talk.